So the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all.
So good morning, and the announcements have not been. So here in Philadelphia, we've got two meetings per week to carry out the declaration here in this city, and our lodge is open on a Sunday morning, of course. The meeting is from 11 to 12. The doors open at 10:30, and for the rest of this month, we are studying this pamphlet, An Epitome of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, which is a kind of a synthesis or an outline or perhaps even a Reader's Digest condensed version of salient points of the philosophy of theosophy. That's what we're doing on Sundays. On Wednesdays, we are currently studying the Bhagavad Gita, and we'll finish that at the end of September. Each Wednesday evening, the doors open at 5:15 because we have a reference library from 5:15 to 7:15. And then at 7:30, the meetings begin, which is basically a reading by several students, and then plenty of time, as always, for questions and answers. We have a book table where one can purchase at cost straight line theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, and magazines, etc. And this lodge is entirely sustained by voluntary contributions of time, money, and effort. There are no dues. We do not pass the hat. Nevertheless, all contributions are gratefully received, yet there is no obligation imposed nor implied. We will now have today's portion of the Epitome of Theosophy from pages 23 to 26 summarized. And it has all to do with karma and spirituality.
So we start off then with a definition of karma, and it's two things: the law of ethical causation and the balance or excess of merit or demerit in any individual. Sometimes people call it luck. We can also look at it in reality as being one's just deserts. And we need to know that karma is not exhausted in any single life. And it is not necessarily that what we are experiencing now is what we have earned from the previous life, but it could be multiple lives in the past from various causes. And the principal cause, it says, for this difference in are we experiencing karma from exact period before or way back, is the failure of the ego to acquire a body which will furnish the instrument by which previous lives can have their effect and be ripened. Namely, is this body that we have now the appropriate one to fulfill the karmic duties that we have now? And he calls it the mysterious power in man's thoughts, and again, of the immediate succeeding life or many lives distant. And we need the appropriate body to fulfill these. And this is an interesting sentence. It goes, karma will influence the soul in the direction for sometimes three lives before the beneficial or bad effect of any sort of karma can be felt. And different types of karma can come together at any one time. So we can't say now that what is happening to us is because of what we did in the exact previous life, because it's from different lives, depending upon what body we have, our thoughts. So it's not a linear type of expression. It is caused by many different things. And in regards to the whole process of karma has to do with evolution. And he calls it a reunion with the divine, is the ultimate goal of evolution. And he says a successive elevation from rank to rank. And those that are still in bodily form are sages, rishis, brothers, and masters. When union with the divine is effected, all the events and experiences of each incarnation are known. And we know that people say, oh, I wish I knew what I had done wrong in a past life to warrant this, but we probably wouldn't be able to handle it if we knew what that was. So then the next part is about the process of spiritual development. And he comments on four different ideas. The first one is the essence of the process lies in the securing of supremacy to the highest, the spiritual, the element of man's nature. And the second idea has four items that goes along with it. And in order, this is regarding how we obtain the securing of supremacy and the highest spiritual idea. And talking about getting rid of all selfishness in all forms and cultivating sympathy and only wanting the highest good for all. The second part of that is cultivating one's inner nature by meditation, trying to commune with the divine, and it suggests using Patanjali's in regards to trying to focus our meditation. And also to control our fleshy appetites and desires, all of those lower nature examples. And of course, doing your duty as long as it comes to you and without any desire of reward, and leaving the results to the law. The third idea is that that talks about while the above is important, it talks about a higher plane of spiritual attainment is conditioned upon having the a course of training, physical, intellectual, and spiritual, by which the internal faculties are aroused and then developed. And the last one, and this is the end of the part for today, is that an extension of this process is reached, when it is reached, we're looking at the idea of adeptship, Mahatmaship, and then the states of Rishis, sages, and Dhyan Shohans. And the whole idea is to approach the divine in all that we do.
So this part interrelates very definitely karma with spiritual development. One is impossible without the other. Any contributions on the ideas presented? Yes.
Are we given any idea about how this process unfolds with those beings that have perfected themselves or nearly perfected themselves? The end of the part, you know, the sages, rishis, mahatmas, adepts. Do we have any idea what today experience, or so, is that beyond our ken?
Well, so what's going on there in terms of that fourth, the fourth, what does he call them? Fourth of the four processes. If just by means of, as above, so below, we would imagine, and it's probably certain, that attaining that level of wisdom and universal thought and such a broad sense of love for all of humanity is the natural outgrowth of living according to the law. Now, there are laws, undoubtedly, that are rather recondite that we may, at this stage of the game, know absolutely nothing of. There may be laws that we have learned but have lost knowledge of because we abused them. But this process, apparently it would seem that the human being goes through to become a Mahatma, is the full flowering of the human being in his full spiritual self. Yes.
So couldn't we say that they balanced out all their own personal karma, dealt with all that, and now they're working with us, but they know when to help and when not to help, what is useful and what is not. And as it's said that they only influence some of the minor currents, but they're not going to learn, they can't learn our lessons for us. We need to learn the lessons. But they can make adjustments, maybe like a chiropractor in a sense, adjusting here and there, but not going overboard.
So, first, with respect to karma, you're right. Karma, it's not that the Mahatma does not experience karma, but rather he has command over himself. And so all of the causes he puts into effect are in perfect accord with universal law. So there's nothing personal coming back to him. He's doing what is needed to be done for, because he knows it's the best thing to be done. How so? In a completely selfless way, if we just follow those four steps in the second of those of the second points, in a completely selfish, generous way, having already worked on himself and developed himself, his inner nature is to full bloom at this stage of evolution. He has dismissed or conquered all of his personal desires to the point, and we'll use the word ambition there, to the point where his use of desire is aspiration to be of service to all. And then finally, of course, knowing his duty is not to do our duty, but his duty is to perhaps serve as the philosopher, guide, and teacher, participate in and perhaps create opportunities for growth, just as a teacher would for a student. You know, the parent knows what lessons the child needs to learn, and may create the conditions or participate in the creation of the conditions as part of the whole parent-child relationship, so that the student will have the opportunity to learn and work through the challenges. Yes, in the pink.
You think it is said that they work with us through suggestion. So if we get an impulse or a thought to do something good, we shouldn't reject it. It may be an important step for us. But we think it's always important to realize that an adept is not without karmic reactions coming towards them. I think we all know that Pythagoras was an amazing soul. He was murdered. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at it all and realize the great sacrifice that they make. I mean, obviously he didn't, quote, deserve to be murdered, but someone had such a rage of some kind that they had to act on it. So their sacrifice is beyond our ken.
Thank you. And the first part of this contribution had to do with how open are we to the suggestion? Do we even know when a suggestion comes, when a certain feeling? And that might be directly related to our individual effort that we make in terms of what? The cultivation of the inner spiritual man. Mr. Judge in this part talks of according to the processes of Patanjali, we think it's in this part. But so it would seem the more we work on ourselves through meditation and reflection and taking responsibility for everything, really the more we're open to our inner nature or our higher nature. And the more we're open to that, really that's where and how we communicate with the elder brothers. So it could come as an aspiration in, you know, something we bring back from a dream, or it can come as a specific intuitive knowledge of do something the right way at the right time. And it may come to us from them. We may not know the source, but sometimes we might intuit. And probably, if we think probably that might be the source, then we're probably right. It's, you know, we remember in the army, it was if a general ever makes a suggestion to you, it's an order, you know. Okay, there was a hand here. Yeah.
Well, yes. I think we are told that we should reflect on our higher self as being the Mahatma and that great soul. But that Mahatma is not outside of us. It's within us. The only way we will reach that is within. And I think what is being talked about here is how you develop these inner senses by digesting these words, you know, by by securing supremacy to the higher spiritual elements in our nature. You know, we're not going to find them outside of our nature. We have to find them within our nature. And all of these are things for us to place before ourselves. Not that they will be attained in this lifetime, but they should be recognized. And that if, you know, we are limited by our own imagination. So, you know, I think our imagination is being checked, tested, and verified about what our potential is.
Thank you. So the contribution here has to do with, you know, theosophically speaking, we are hardly taught to pray to the Mahatmas or to ask the Mahatmas for their support or to ask for their guidance. That's not what it's about. What's it all about is self-directed attention and self-directed effort. So if, as was suggested in the contribution, is if we take as the premise that the Mahatma is within, really our efforts to evolve, to improve ourselves in service to others, we find the help that we receive is the very source, the very same source as that of the Mahatma, but it's from within our own nature. So the point being, we're not told to ask for help or pray to anything, but really to be self, what's the word? We're looking for self-developed, no, self,
reduced.
Self-reliant. That's it. So self-reliant. Now, it would seem if we're working on ourselves and making the effort and doing what's right because it's there to be done, if along the way it is recognized, if your light is shining and it's recognized and there can be help that's given, then there's help that's given. But don't rely on it and don't ask for it from an outside, so to speak, God. Let's not make gods of these Mahatmas. They're people too. They're people too, and they're here to serve according to their wisdom, not according to what we think they should do for us. Yes?
That one large paragraph, there's a section that talks about influence on the soul in that direction for sometimes three lives. That's so specific. Now, we don't quite understand if that's, I mean, are we really saying three lives or?
Well, whatever it may be, it's probably a big deal. Let's think of certain examples. One example may be, you know, from life to life, our understanding is, you know, you're not going to be a male in one life and a female in another and every other one. But there is a progression. There is, you know, there's maybe an easing into. And so it may be several lives that one experiences finally, you know, at first they acquire the body of the opposite sex from where they were and come to more fully and fully experience the nature of that sex, and it may not just all happen in one lifetime. That may be it. Another may be we have been perhaps so imbued or embossed with the false ideas of an orthodox or dogmatic religion. Well, it may take that long, and then we're introduced to the more universal philosophy. It may take that long to shirk off the old ideas and move in a direction toward greater understanding. And so we may be in that student mode in particular as the primary thrust of that life. Yes?
I wish I could remember the source, but elsewhere Mr. Judd says, if we don't take some steps to change something or improve something, the result will last for at least three lives. And if we stop and think about it, how long it takes to change something when you're making the effort. If you're not making the effort, the thing wears out as an acting mechanism for you. You're going to have to face it again. until you do work it out.
So what we're saying here then is if we recognize that a change is needed and make that effort, the very energy that we've been using in that direction, we can use that energy and turn it around or transmute it and head in a different way. But if we don't, then it's just going, you know, inertia can last for a long time. If there's no conflict or if there's no friction to stop it, you know, it's going to go for a much longer time. So it's about reflection and self-awareness. Mr. Judge says, and we think that was in Letters That Have Helped Me, that it can go on for several lives. What was that? Yes. Yeah, well, what is going on? HBB talked about that. She talked about, we believe the word she used was the crack in the foundation of the church. Is it a loss of interest by the laity generally, perhaps? Could it be the result of broad secular education and critical thinking? That's probably contributing to it as well. Could it be the fact that, you know, the untoward problems that we've seen in the news for the past perhaps 10 years that are so obvious. But also, it's no surprise, in the 1970s, 1975 is the beginning of a new cycle, and it was right then that Pope John Paul I, interestingly enough, refused to take the papal vow. Now, that was the first pope in about 1,500 years who refused to take the papal vow. He was dead about 30 days later or so. And no pope since then has taken the papal vow. It could be the actual attendance. It could be something, you know, at the helm. We don't mean to speculate, but isn't it interesting to read the teachings and see how they manifest over the course of the many decades since the teachings were presented? Yes.
Well, the church has lost its moral direction, but it has for centuries, and it was condemned. You know, the Dark Ages, the Reformation. You know, I mean, there was a church that had power in that, and yet the same thing is happening, but it's happening morally as well. Well, that was more with Hossa when they did that. So you see that there's a people need something that's real. And that's why theosophy, you know, has to be, we have to somehow infiltrate the ideas around us with this mindset that we're all one. Doing this all together, and that there's oneness, and there's a system of thought, and reincarnation of karma, you know, just the whole premise of our existence. You know, I think that's what's happened to the church. They no longer teach that, if they ever did.
Mm-hmm. So the contribution here then is, you know, everything that was born in time or created in time will die in time. You know, anything made by man is going to die in time, and the Catholic Church is no exception. Nevertheless, we'll make the difference between churchianity and Christianity, and that there are people, there are teachings for those who are looking for it. It's in there, and it's in all of the world's religions. More importantly, is the ethics of each of the world's religions, as opposed to the deeper teachings. The ethics of the world's religions is what was needed, probably still is, during the Dark Ages, and the effort, no matter what religion one is in, if they are living that ethic born into that culture for some reason, living that ethic, they are preparing themselves in a future life. They're proving to the universe that they are ready to take the next step and could be open to the truth in the next life. Yes.
Well, we think the next step is that the laws of morality come from within outward, and that they impose morality on us of religion and norms are okay for the creation of harmony, of communication, but if it's not practiced, it'll end up as it is now. We have to come to an understanding of our responsibility and the age that we live in, and just have to try be real rather than talk about something. What is it about that something that's real?
Thank you for the contribution. It's heard. Yes, in the.
And now we were thinking, well, we can never say anymore, well, it just happened overnight. We can see now, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, sometimes we slip, sometimes we fall, sometimes we graze, but nothing happens just, we seem to think it happened just like that. But it takes a lot in the making.
Takes a lot in the making for some of these big things to happen, whether it's a tectonic shift in the consciousness of man with regard to religion, or whether it's a tectonic shift in our own life, because any major shift in one life could be, the cracking of the egg, but the embryo of the chicken may have been developing for a long time before that, building the muscles to be able to finally crack the egg. And sometimes it seems like, overnight, really, the effect, the cracking of the egg is an effect, and the effect must be sufficient to the cause, or the cause must be sufficient to the effect. And so a lot of work will go into it. Yes, in the corner.
Well, isn't it very interesting? We are here studying and listening to the conversation on action and reaction. Wouldn't you say that our taking up of these studies at the present time are a means for correcting negative karma or instituting a positive opposition to bad karma? So that the idea is that we can take charge. We may not be able to alter certain physical aspects, but the way we think changes.
Well, so part of wisdom is, discernment and discerning, around ourselves, what can we control, what can't we control. Understanding karma is an understanding of personal responsibility. So whether something's coming to us as negative karma, as was implied, and transmuting it into positive karma could very much just be a matter of, our attitude toward it. Even if it's a hugely challenging, blatantly painful experience, perhaps part of that whole experience is we know there are friends or children or someone along the path who's watching how we handle it. And it could be the greatest service to them that they see that we handle it with the right attitude. And that may be a large part of the purpose behind our experiencing this. There's a follow-up? Yeah.
Well, when we first hear the idea of the relationship between our mind and the physical body we're using, see in the present, in the future, they will. So hope.
So, yeah, so what we're talking about is there may be some type of karma that we're expecting to come our way as the result of some certain thoughts or behaviors. But, and this is where Mr. Judge talks about we'll use his sentence, this may be known as the nullification of the postulated effect of the classes of karma. Something may be, you know, expected as the direct result of a cause, but in the meantime, depending on how we're living our lives and what's going on around us, the effect, is it buried in our life somewhere? Sure, but it's not going to be as obvious. You know, it's not going to be. For instance, the child goes out into the ocean, the giant wave comes, swallows him, and he thinks it's over. But his father reaches in, grabs him, and picks him up like this, and it's really not a big deal. It's probably happened to all of us in one way or another. So the karma of having a dad right there at the right time was a pretty good karma. So the point, however, is not to suggest that, let's rephrase that, every cause has an effect. We're not suggesting you can make the effect go away. The suggestion here is that you can postulate what the effect may be, but you don't know all of the other karmic causes that are coming together that will. For instance, one could go into debt and never pay it back, and another person in a similar situation go into the same amount of debt and use that debt to go to college and learn more and earn a whole lot, and he'll pay it back. So debt per se, the cause, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's what we do with it and what our motive is and what our intentions are. Was there a hand here?
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't know what the hand is about.
In the back, please.
We read a great quote. We don't even know who said it. It was, what if the terrible thing that's happening to you right now is the basic building block for the thing you asked for?
What if the terrible thing that's happening to you right now is the basic building block for the thing that you asked for?
That's karma.
That's karma. Welcome to planet Earth. Yes?
Terrible is all a matter of perspective. State of mind, you're interpreting something as being terrible. So you're putting yourself into another state of concern or whatever.
We heard a statement once, you know, the heart goes to the same place when we worry about something as when we aspire to something. You know, it's the same level of power. But so if there's something going on and we have hope, that will actually influence the outcome rather than worrying about it. So when these terrible things come up, you know, successful people know how, you know, one thing that successful people do is look at, highly successful people will look at something and respond to it in a different way than most average people. And which translates into, if they can see the positive, you know, a kernel of opportunity in this ocean of problems, focus on the kernel of opportunity, otherwise you get swallowed up. And sometimes we let ourselves get swallowed up, that's true. But it's all a matter of how we're gonna handle it. It's individual, yeah.
But even the inability to bring your attitude up to where you think it should be can be karma. So the individual struggles with, oh, I've got to have hope, I've got to make an effort, and they can't. And maybe that's the lesson to learn, how important an attitude is. I mean, we never know why we go through what we go through until we learn the lesson. And then it said, once we learn the lesson, the problem disappears.
Once we learn the lesson, the problem disappears. part of that lesson, actually, right, so when we are faced with some of these challenges, barring situations where we're in a place where we temporarily can't pull ourselves out, let's remember that we can pull ourselves out of it because we're here on this plane of thought, and we have the ability because of the contrast, you know, in the contrast that we have in the higher and lower mind on this plane, on this physical plane, gives us the ability, typically, not always, depending on the circumstances, to pull ourselves out if we choose to. The contra of that is when we're in Kamaloka, we're in Kamaloka, and you don't have the option to pull. We don't have our option to pull ourselves out of it. It's just a matter, it's just energy that's going to have to fade out in time through inertia. But we can transmute it while we're here. Let's bear that in mind. Was there a hand up over here? Yes.
Well, there's a story about a young man named Blind Tom. Deaf, dumb, and blind. To make the story short.
Well, he wasn't deaf. He could play the piano. He was blind.
He was blind.
Right, and he didn't speak. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know, but the idea is a perfect example. It was his good karma. Somebody was there to help you. I don't recall all the tale, but when I said deaf, dumb, blind, that made it even worse. It's my understanding that he overcame all of that. Sure. So, to go to a better example, there are people in prison who infect themselves with all kinds of diseases and so forth. And they are treated by physicians. They have given themselves to health medicine, prove the efficiency of certain drugs to cure. That's the same thing, where you can take on these pains and suffering and give yourself to help nature, you know what I mean, the community and the people cure themselves. What is that called?
Well, the contribution here sounds like it would be sacrifice. But are we saying people in prison are used as guinea pigs by drug companies? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes.
Does that happen?
There's a book called Acres of Skin that was written about Holmesburg Prison. It has been done. Don't know if it's still being done.
Wow.
It certainly has been done.
Interesting. So, yeah, sacrifice.
They sacrificed their lives.
Mm-hmm.
For the benefit of the community. That's countering the conflict.
Yes.
We don't know if anyone else has had the opportunity to see this blog by this young girl with cystic fibrosis. And her attitude was absolutely beautiful. And she was trying to make people understand it doesn't matter what you're going through, you can live and you can grow. And just to watch her and her energy was truly beautiful. And she finally got a lung transplant and died a week later.
Hmm.
It's just an amazing young woman. I should let you know the name so that you can...
So someone along that line, you know, is it not possibly the karma of that individual to suffer the disease of cystic fibrosis? Perhaps that has something to do with it. But also to live a life of example and compassion and give other people opportunity to live with her and help her and see her shine in spite of her challenges takes quite a soul. Yes.
So are we looking for heroes?
Are we looking for heroes? Are we looking for heroes? Be your own hero. Are we looking for heroes?
Yes, but I need examples, especially if I have reason to feel down about myself, you know, whatever. We need examples above us, and we should look for heroes. The problem is we usually make heroes out of the wrong people, like the, you know, the sports people or the actors, and they don't represent what we need.
And it's completely ridiculous and unwise to actually make heroes out of them. Now, heroes in ancient times were examples of how to handle challenges. Hercules and Achilles and Odysseus, they went through these great challenges, and the stories were passed down generation to generation so that the young man could think, well, what would Hercules do in a scenario like this, ethically speaking? And it was even expected that he would behave accordingly. Then something happened, and the hero was taken, and the prophet was someone that an outside God put on the earth, and you're to do what he says. And the savior is someone, you can't be like him, you can try, you better do what he says. But something happened in Western civilization where the idea of the ancient Greek heroes was stripped and replaced by something that was unattainable. Because why? Because you're a weak, miserable sinner. And that is the misconception when it comes to heroes. So we pick these basketball stars rather than the local whoever, teacher, whatever. Okay, in the black shirt first and then the blue, please.
There is a handful of them that seem to realize that they have been given a gift of having this money, and they are they're doing it behind the scenes. They're not broadcasting what they're doing, but they're helping others. They're making use. Some of them are being spokespersons for different organizations and raising money and giving their own money to some of these places. And they're not doing it because they want to be looked at as being exceptional. They're doing it because they realize that they can.
We hear the contribution. We think the point here is that if a sports figure, for one example, is held up and the goal is to, and the child is taught to that success, attain that, and he doesn't attain that, then he's a failure. But there's another way to raise your children, and that is, you know, in his efforts to be the best football player or hockey player or whatever that he can be, rather than trying to become some unrealistic lucky person, we'll use that word loosely, you know, help the child see that he's learning and growing in a lot of different ways by playing this sport, and what he's learning in self-discipline, in focus, in priorities, in how to be a team player, in sacrificing his own ego because it's better for the group. There are so many lessons to be learned, but those lessons are often not taught. Instead, the focus is on just trying to be, you know, the top of the heap. When really sports per se is a wonderful opportunity for the development of character if it's guided properly by coaches and parents. Yes. Oh wait, there's a hand. Wait, there was a hand in the back in the blue, and then yeah.
It talks about subordinating. Deliberately subordinating all the material interests and desires of a lower nature, subordinating that to the behest of the spirit. Do we have any examples other than maybe saints and sages that have been able to do this, or is that, or once you do this, you're basically a saint?
Subordinating the, where is that?
It's
said in C, yeah, okay. The control of the fleshly appetites, desires, material interests being deliberately subordinated to the behests of the spirit. So, our understanding in a practical way is. The behests of the Spirit is, you know, is where are we when we are meditating? Because when we're meditating, often we're in a slightly, can we say, different place than in the craziness of the world. Now, when we meditate, if we take up the practice to do so, that has an effect on our lower nature, because we open ourselves to the wisdom of our higher nature. So what does that have to do with this? Well, things that we think are important, things that we personally desire, often will rearrange themselves. Our priorities change, our values change as we meditate and open ourselves to the higher nature. We see more what's important, what's not important. So when we talk about material interests being deliberately subordinated to the behests of the Spirit, it's a matter of, you know, we're making room. When we make room, even making the time of the day to meditate, and then the whole process of change, transmuting desires, is a matter of letting go of that which we realize is not important anymore, and having fewer desires that we aspire to rather than have ambition for it. Yeah.
But the whole yoga is non-attachment.
Right.
So the things that we have difficult with are attachments. The things that we want in others are our attachments.
So right, so our desires, you know, that's our attachments, so to speak, and when we do meditate, what we see as important or what we're attached to, what we want, that will often change, leaving the material behind, the ambition and power, and replacing it nevertheless with desires, but aspiration to be of greater service. Is that?
Yeah.
Yes.
If I start eating more healthily, if I give up smoking, if I exercise more, does it make me a saint? And yet I am doing exactly what that says. I'm taking a higher position and bringing my desires and attachments to a different level. So it's a normal thing that most people do. They just don't realize there's an even greater voyage or path or journey that they could take. They don't know their own power.
And so these steps that they do take, it's right to take that simply for the health of the body, to live a full, healthy life in service to your family, and or... if it's a matter of, if the intention is because we have learned the value of our physical health along the spiritual path, which is what this part is about, is karma and spiritual development, the teaching is that having a healthy body, as healthy as we can make it, checked by karma in this lifetime, is part and parcel to the process of spiritual development. Yes?
We think this part on the second page gives us a prescription. When union with the divine is effective, all events and experiences of each incarnation are known. And then it says, as to the process of spiritual development, the Theosophy teaches, and it gives us several, the essence of the process, and how it's attained along four lines. And then it goes on, cultivation of the inner, control, careful performance of duty. Then it goes on and on. So what we're offering here is a prescription to take charge of one's life.
Right, and that prescription, those four, A, B, C, and D, are the means by which we're able to put the higher soul, make the soul, as Lord over the body. It's one thing to tell someone you have to be a good person, you have to be more spiritual. Your spiritual life is more important than your physical life. Kind of sounding like a priest. But theosophy, the study of theosophy, is the study of the science of how to do it. And each of those four points, A, B, C, and D, is a huge study in and of itself. But we don't do one, then the next, then the next, then the next. We learn about all of them, test them, apply them, see how they work together, and before we know it, we wonder if somehow, some way, it's not having an effect by following these ideas. Yes?
So to go along with that, the third point talks about a specific course of training, physical, intellectual, and spiritual, which will change the internal faculties. What do they mean by a specific course?
Right. Well, we think that likely would fall under the category of when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Yes?
You know, living the Bhagavad Gita, there's a course of action. And our silent meditation, that attitude of life. To act and give everything up to the highest in our own nature. So it's not attachment. It's doing things because they need to be done, and sacrificing the results to the all or to the universe.
So it's a matter of doing things because they need to be done, which in a word is virtue. And Mr. Judge tells us that it's living the life of virtue that sets up certain causes within ourselves, and he literally uses the phrase that karma accumulates merit. Karma accumulates merit, which sets up the causes so that we will be born, into a family in a future life with people around us who are far further along the way than we had been. And that future life may literally be a biological family, or we may be born, so to speak, into ourselves in this life and look around us at our family or our neighbors and realize that my friends at work are much more further along the lines than I ever gave them credit for, because the student was ready and they saw it in another. Yeah.
Or I may find myself in a group like this, studying these ancient ideas.
Which is one of the wonderful benefits of committing to a life of virtue, as Mr. Judge would say, yes. And then, yeah.
And we'll always come back together again the more we infuse these ideas into our very being. You know, just the ideas of trying to we're contributing to the universe as it is now, but we think we're so infinitesimal that it doesn't matter how we think and feel, but it'll all be ground up with time. But we're told it's not.
And who knows what a life of dedication toward living and learning these ideas, what are we setting up in a future life, what kind of brain and body are we setting the groundwork for that we'll be able to use in yet a more powerful, positive way. So with that idea, we're going to adjourn the meeting, and we'll see you for the Gita class on Wednesday evenings.